Welcome back to Backbone Radio. Ross Kaminsky in the studio here at News Talk 710 KNUS. Simulcasting on 1460 KZNT in Colorado Springs. In a letter in 1788, slightly before FDR's time, Thomas Jefferson wrote, "The natural progress of things is for liberty to yield and government to gain ground." And few people put their foot on the accelerator of that particular prediction like FDR did, both domestically through the New Deal and, as I want to hear from Bert and Anita Folsom right now, he also used the emergency of World War II to continue to expand his own power and the power of government. So we're joined by Bert and Anita Folsom from Hillsdale College. Their book, FDR Goes to War, go on Amazon.com, buy the book. Bert and Anita, again, thanks for spending time with us this Sunday. And how tell us a little bit about how did FDR use World War II to increase his own power and the power of government, and especially in ways that are still with us today?
Right, Ross, thanks. Yes, he did. For example, we hear about the czars today. The first czars appeared in World War II. The idea that you're going to give a lot of power and that Congress will yield on this, that we'll give a lot of power to somebody to be a food czar, a labor czar, this kind of thing. We see that during World War II. We see education, which was a private function. You know, George Washington wanted to have an American university and have Congress establish it, but Congress refused to do it because it was a state and local function. Education needs to be a state and local function, most of the founders thought, because you don't want what the government's doing interfering with the teaching of liberty that's going on in the elementary schools, in high schools, and colleges. But that intertwining of government and education has started in a big way with research activities, with the GI Loan Bill after the war. Roosevelt gets that, so that, in other words, the federal government will encroach on various authorities that state and local government had in education. Wiretapping. Roosevelt was wiretapping constantly during World War II. He said he needed to do it to catch enemies, and yet we find out that he was wiretapping Republicans, that he was wiretapping interested in people like Hamilton Fish, who was his congressman, a Republican, in New York. He wiretapped his own wife, Eleanor. So in other words, you start with, oh, we need to wiretap because it's an emergency, and pretty soon you're wiretapping lots of different people. The United States is built on a constitutional government. We know about the rights that we have in the Bill of Rights, and yet 110,000 Japanese were put into internment camps because Roosevelt argued that they might be a threat. Actually, they were a threat to his, in some ways, to his winning elections, because right after the 1944 election, he agreed, hey, we can start letting them out. But having them in there helped me carry California. So some of that, and there were other things going on other than pure election motives, but I'm just saying that was part of it. And you get a group of people that's going to be put in interned and confined against their will. The taxes are going to go up to pay for so much of what Roosevelt wanted to do. Taxes going up then become a precedent for taxes remaining high after the war. You can always use high taxes as an excuse to pay for war material, but then Roosevelt's argument, and even Truman picked this up after the war, is that they needed to remain high because now the government needs to have a more active role in the economy. The top rate of the income tax at the end of World War II on people who had incomes of if you earn more than $200,000, the tax you paid on all income over $200,000 was 94% of all that you earned above $200,000. If you earned $300,000 on your last $100,000, you'd keep $6,000 and send $94,000 to Washington, D.C. So what we see is a big growth of government by Franklin Roosevelt during World War II.
So I'm kind of curious, thinking as a supply-sider, what actually happened to tax receipts and people's incentive to work when they raised taxes like that? Did they actually generate additional revenue for the federal government with those kind of taxes?
They did during World War II, but remember, people were highly motivated by the war effort. And as Bert said earlier, many, many people working in plants, in these defense plants, had sons in the military, and during World War II, maybe even daughters in the military. But people very much wanted to win the war. Even so, there was much more of a problem. We talk about this in our book, FDR Goes to War. There was a large problem during World War II with absenteeism in plants, in the war defense plants, because the work was dangerous. The death rates in a lot of plants went way up during the war from accidents. And the other thing is plants such as the airplane plant outside of Detroit in Ypsilanti called Willow Run, they never did have enough workers to fill all of the slots they had for jobs. And part of that was, you know, you worked and worked and worked, then you had to give the government an awful lot of what you made in taxes.
So, I mean, we're still living with so much of FDR's legacy today. I understand that FDR got into the war and that it's entirely possible that, you know, residents of London and Paris would be speaking German right now, if not for us. You know, considering that, you know, and I do give FDR
sure.
credit for that, how do you in your own mind balance all the pluses and minuses of FDR, what he did and didn't do over his career? How do you rate him as a president?
Well, I'll let Bert rate him because he's the official historian. But here's one thing I would say, and that is I don't think for certainly the Japanese would not have tried to do what they did in the Pacific. They wouldn't have attacked the Philippines and Hawaii and Wake Island and all those other spots if we had not been so weak. And we were weak because FDR cut the military budget for 7 years from 34 until 41, he cut the military budget over and over and over again. Now, he did, in the summer of 40, I said 41, but the summer of 40, he did pass bills to give the military huge money. But that weakness attracts a bully, and at that point, Japan was the bully.
Well, Bert, before you rate FDR, I would just comment on what Anita just said. It
sure.
reminds me frighteningly of what I think is going on in America today. I mean, I'm not one of these people who thinks that every dollar spent on in the name of defense is a dollar
sure.
well spent. But
yeah.
still, with the Obama's, you know, defense cuts and the way that the sequestering when the super committee couldn't get the budget cuts done, half of the cut went to the Defense Department. What's your take on that?
No, this is, we've had a lot of people tell us that when they read FDR Goes to War or they read New Deal or Raw Deal, it's like reading the present day situation. It's as though Obama has used the Franklin Roosevelt playbook to guide a lot of what he does in his administration. And we do see this because President Obama, exactly as you say, if you want to spend more money on programs, especially because the more you give to these voters, the more votes you get in return. And that's the way to get some votes, that cutting the military is the way to go about doing that, and that was the decision that Roosevelt made to making these relative cuts on the military and expanding social programs, the WPA, the AAA, and so on, initially the NRA, all of this, expand the TVA, expand those programs, and then cut the military is a way to do well to win votes. And, of course, we do see that also happening today, so I think you're right, Ross.
So let's get to the question then, Bert, of how do you rate FDR?
Well, let's historians in polls, and I've been asked to rate presidents in polls, but the leading polls, the Schlesinger poll, for example, has ranked Roosevelt either in the top two or so each time. Usually it's under Abraham Lincoln, sometimes ahead of George Washington, which is quite startling to think that Roosevelt, with all that high unemployment and the abuse of civil liberties and the expansion of government, would be rated that high. Typically, Roosevelt, though, is rated first, second, or third by most historians. He finishes somewhere in there in the poll, sometimes first, sometimes second, sometimes third. And I would rate him down in the bottom three. I would rate him as one of the in the bottom three worst presidents in our history. And the reason I say that, I give him credit for winning the war, and that's why I think that he did give the incentives to business to do the rankings so that he deserves to be higher than the bottom on the rankings because of the incentives. But still, the abuse of civil liberties, the tremendous growth of debt, the high taxes, the precedent for the expansion of government, and the inability to eliminate unemployment, all of this, I think, causes him to rank somewhere in the bottom 10% of our presidents.
We've got about a minute and a half left in this segment. Fred has a question for you.
Very, very quick question. So part of my background is I'm a mechanical engineer, and I know that during the war, there were some really phenomenal things that were done by American industry, whether it was the work of John Kaiser and ramping up the Liberty Ship programs,
yes,
or the speed with which the Boeing company and all the other aerospace companies were able to make airplanes at a huge, fast rate and improve the designs, et cetera. And these breakthroughs, to me, speak not only of tremendous motivation, which you've kind of addressed, but also a knack of putting the right people in the right place. And I wonder, my question for you is, given what you know about Roosevelt, was that one of the talents that this man had?
No, he wasn't very good at picking winners. Industry really had to go out there and find the people. Because of the depression during the 30s, I think there were a lot of talented people out there with ideas who wanted to put them into practice. And finally, when industry was encouraged, see, suddenly we had this flowering of ideas.
Interesting. So,
yeah, and Higgins, I mean, for example, Higgins and Kaiser, the Higgins boats, Eisenhower said, really won the war for us, because there with that landing craft that Higgins invented and developed, we didn't have to land our troops in a port. You know, of course, it's easy for the Germans. If they know you have to land in a port, they can put their troops on the port. But if you can go somewhere that's not in a port, which Higgins boats enables us to do, then you've made a real technological accomplishment.
We've got to hit a break right here. When we come back for our last segment together with Bert and Anita Folsom, their book, FDR Goes to War, I want to ask you, Bert and Anita, did World War II end the Great Depression, as so many people think that it did? So we'll ask Bert and Anita Folsom that question when we come back right after these words on Backbone Radio. Don't forget, Victor Davis Hanson at 7:05. Stay with us on Backbone Radio. Welcome back to Backbone Radio. Ross Kaminsky in studio. Congratulations again to the Denver Broncos for an incredible win over the Pittsburgh Steelers. In overtime, we're joined by Bert and Anita Folsom of Hillsdale College. Their book, FDR Goes to War. Go to Amazon.com, buy that book, FDR Goes to War. Now, Bert and Anita, one of the greatest bits of, well, let me just throw my own bias in here. One of the greatest bits of mythology in modern political economy, in modern political economic history, is that World War II ended the Depression. So many people think it did. I don't think it did. You're the experts. What do you think?
No, that's a good question, and you're right. That's a huge question, because if the war did end the Great Depression, then at least in passing, Roosevelt deserves credit for that. On the surface, it seems like he did, because people use unemployment statistics, and hey, you know, we mentioned that during the New Deal years, we had 20% unemployment after 7 years of Roosevelt in office. And here, all of a sudden, World War II comes around, and we're down to virtually 0% unemployment. And then after the war, we did not have high unemployment. So it looks like, hey, the war got us out. I think if you look at the evidence, it plays out much differently, Ross. For example, you have 12 million people or so who are being taken into the military. That's roughly the number who are unemployed. So what you've really done is you've transferred people from being unemployed because of high taxes and bad policies to sending them off overseas to fight. Plus, they have to have food, they have to have clothing, they have to have guns and ammunition. So it's expensive. Thus, the national debt during World War II increases from about $40 to $45 billion to $260 billion. We have a sixfold increase.
That's back when $200 billion was real money.
That was when it was real money, when people were happy to be making $3,000 or $4,000 a year. And you know, you talk about a debt then of that kind of $260 billion. So now we have an interest payment on the national debt that is almost as big as the national debt was when Roosevelt became president. So what we've done is we traded unemployment for debt. You know, we always could have gotten 0% unemployment if we just simply had the unemployed people pick up spoons and dig a hole with those spoons and then pay them at the end of the day, that would reduce the national debt. The point is you can't do that just by fighting a war. The question is what happens after the war when the 12 million people come home, and that's the key issue. Senator George, head of the Senate Finance Committee, said he had a letter from constituents, and he said, and we quote this in our book, if we are to be subject to the present excess profits tax, we are being impractical to risk starting a business. The point is the high taxes will not enable business people to start to create jobs. Therefore, Congress, contrary to Roosevelt, Roosevelt died, Truman came in, and Congress cut taxes. They cut dramatically the income tax. They cut the corporate tax from a top level of 90% to 38%.
And Truman supported that, or?
Truman reluctantly did. Now, Roosevelt might have vetoed it, but he was dead, and Truman reluctantly, in some ways, went along with it.
Truman didn't believe in the tax cuts, but he did go along with them. And the tax cuts, we maintain in the final chapter of FDR Goes to War, are what got the U.S. out of the Great Depression.
It sounds a lot like Bill Clinton reluctantly going on with capital gains tax cuts that then gave him
exactly.
the surplus that he crowed about, still crows about forever, and Clinton going along with the welfare reform.
You are exactly right. That's a very good parallel. The welfare reform cut half the people off the welfare rolls, almost half, and the capital gains tax cut spurred investment, and lo and behold, the United States is all of a sudden having budget surpluses in the late 1990s, and we saw the same phenomenon take place after World War II. We cut taxes, we sparked investment, and we all of a sudden, we had, as you know, I mean, in industries like television, you know, Xerox machines, Holiday Inns, McDonald's, all of those come in the decade after the World War II, and we see all of that come, and these people, those entrepreneurs, are willing to take the risk because we're going to let them keep the money they make, and then there are jobs for the soldiers coming home.
So what was the timing of the Truman tax cut versus the end of the war? And I guess what I want to ask is, was there any temporary spike in unemployment right after the war as people started coming home? How did that work?
Well, I'll let Bert address most of that. There were a lot of upheavals. Coming out of the war was almost as much a dislocation as going into it. There was a huge rail strike that Truman tried to deal with. It wasn't very effective. There was inflation. There was some unemployment. So there were lots of theories on what should be done. It was a tough time. And people then also were adjusting. Suddenly your husband you hadn't seen in maybe 2 or 3 years is back home, and he hasn't seen you or the children in that time. It was a time of tremendous adjustment.
And Bert?
And because of those dislocations, that meant some people said, oh, we need more federal programs. The tax cutters had to argue with people who argued we needed a stimulus package. It was stimulus package or tax cuts was the essential debate. Right in 1945, Congress made the decision to go with the tax cuts, and we began to get very low unemployment. So we had 3.9% unemployment in 1946, 3.9% unemployment in 1947.
So we only have about 2 minutes left here. What really strikes me is that after close to a decade of FDR's redistributive policies, quasi-socialist policies that Barack Obama believes in as well, unemployment remained incredibly high. I mean, you started off this show by saying that when FDR was thinking about getting into World War II, American unemployment was 19%, while European unemployment was 11%.
Correct.
Yes.
And so we have all these years of absolute proof that Keynesian economics doesn't work, and then immediately, even in the 1940s, proof that a tax cut does work, and yet we keep not you and I, but Americans keep buying into Keynesian arguments and electing politicians who want to bankrupt our children. Why is this happening?
Well, the first thing is, one of the things you have to do is get evidence out. That's the part of the reason we wrote the book. But we hope by reading FDR Goes to War that people will say, hey, it's not right to go in a Keynesian direction. It did not work. Education is very important. Getting facts out is important. American people will respond to a vision and people who give them straight facts. And that's what is needed here, and that's what I hope that some of the candidates running for president will be able to do in 2012, is work through the vision and the practical politics of reducing government and promoting growth.
And explaining why that's in the long run good for everybody, and that all these promises of, you know, free goodies for everyone are a disaster in the long run.
Historically, that is what we see, Ross. Not just now, but we saw it in the 30s and 1940s.
Bert and Anita Folsom, thank you so much for your time. Everyone, go to Amazon.com, find FDR Goes to War and buy it. Also, Bert's previous book, New Deal or Raw Deal, an amazing read. Thanks again, Bert and Anita Folsom. I really appreciate your time. Have a great week and a great 2012.
Thank you, Ross.
Thanks a lot, Ross.
When we come back after these words, we're going to be joined by Victor Davis Hanson. Most of you probably know who he is. If not, go to victorhanson.com. He's one of the great thinkers in America today. We're going to talk to him about President Obama, including an article that he wrote recently entitled When the Legend Becomes Fact, Print the Legend. Stay with us right here on Backbone Radio. Victor Davis Hanson coming up in 6 minutes.